Next lecture, Professor Gallo, Bethesda, Human Retroviruses, a Decade of Discovery and Linkage to Disease.
Professor Petrov and Professor Ivanov, first, thank you very much for the honor of giving the Ovchinnikov lecture with Janet Raleigh, and thank you very much for the beautiful painting. My old friend Rolf Nath, thank you for helping arrange for my first visit to the Soviet Union. Like my colleagues, this is a most exciting time for us to visit, and I guess I would say, at least for me, I think it's the events happening here are the most important, perhaps in the history of the last 1,000 years of civilization. So it's a special time to be here. I'm going to talk about the interaction of some viruses with cells of the hematopoietic system. Many people who work in this field, and some people who work at this institute, are interested in viruses and their infection of hematopoietic cells really as tools to insert genes and as tools to study gene regulation or as tools to study cellular and molecular bases of transformation in vitro. But I'd like to speak about viruses as viruses, namely viruses as causes of diseases, particularly in man. Janet Raleigh mentioned how 5, 10, 15 years ago, there wasn't the general acceptance of the concept that genes were critical to leukemias and lymphomas, to disorders of hematopoietic cells, and how she rightfully said championed that notion for a long time before its acceptance. In a somewhat analogous way, if the clock was turned back to the 1970s, there was a general feeling that viruses were ruled out as causes of human cancers. And there was a feeling strongly that retroviruses in particular didn't exist in human beings. We now know that viruses, either directly or indirectly, either as a cofactor or a direct cause, play a role in human cancers as much as 40%, some people say 50%, some think more. We also know, of course, now that human retroviruses do exist, and even that there's multiple types of human retroviruses. During the 1970s, at least in the United States, there was also a feeling that serious, fatal, epidemic, or pandemic diseases were passé. Infectious diseases that would become global epidemics or serious problems for the so-called industrialized nations were no longer a problem. Such diseases were really a problem for the less privileged nations. We had not only antibiotics, but we had better sanitary conditions, public health measures, and epidemic diseases were not being seen. In retrospect, the last great pandemic that affected the United States, Europe, and the world was not so long ago, only 60, 70 years ago, namely the great influenza epidemic of 1918-1919. And if one re-reviews the history of microbiology, there are often periods where epidemics disappear and mysteriously reappear much longer than 60 or 70 years. They can be absent for 100 or 200 years and then suddenly reemerge. So perhaps we had too much confidence in thinking epidemics were a thing of the past. And as you know, we now have this epidemic, pandemic, the acquired immunodeficiency syndrome. There was also the feeling, in fact, many times published, that a pandemic disease is not possible unless the causative agent, the microbe, is casually transmissible. So we now know that we have a pandemic to a microbe which is not casually transmissible, but transmissible only by the closest contact and the exchange of body fluids. I believe that the failure to appreciate the coming of these events was, number one, the failure to remember some of the lessons of past medical history, that often after major changes in society, there are major changes in disease. And the major changes post-World War II were a great increase in travel. the airplane used by just about everyone. The use of blood and blood products going from one nation to another nation. The insane habit of intravenous drug abuse and the increase in sexual contacts. All these things made it possible to transmit something that was remote or rare to become relatively common and global. It also forces us to consider what really is new about this epidemic. It's not new to be a new epidemic. As I mentioned, epidemics appear, disappear, reappear for reasons we often don't understand. Society's response to the epidemic is also not particularly novel, although much media attention to the AIDS epidemic makes it appear as though it were novel. What's novel is the nature of the microbes, the nature of these kinds of viruses. If they weren't novel to us, the problems would have been solved already. I'd like to use a first slide as an illustration of some of the properties of viruses and things that are virus-like that have become increasingly important in the latter part of this century. Their properties are listed on the slide. First of all, they are new, or at least I put it in quotes because they often are not new, but only newly discovered. And second, they are microbes that are often difficult to find. They're difficult to find because they don't replicate very much, or they don't infect so many target cells, or because they are only produced by the target cell during a certain phase of the life of that cell. In fact, with all human retroviruses, all three of these points are true. They don't replicate so much, their target cells are few in number, and they tend to be produced only at a certain phase of that life of that cell, a point I will come back to later. For the reasons that they are difficult to find, they are difficult to transmit. Almost always, they have a very long latency period. This is an important characteristic that also allows their transmission, that also is another reason, rather, why they can become globally transmitted. Because they are present from the time of infection until death, lifelong infection, and during that period can be transmitted to others. When we thought of microbes, especially viruses, we tended to think of things that are catching, something that's transmitted while a person is sick or in the early phase of incubation, which is thought to be a few days, a week, a few months at the most. But with the viruses we're talking about now, they remain in the individual for the life of the individual, and during that period of time they can be transmitted. So we have transmission for years and sometimes for decades, therefore adding to the possibility that a difficult to transmit agent can become global. The very long latency period means that from the time of infection, it may be 5 years, 2 years, 10 years, and in the case of the leukemia viruses, 20, 30 years before the first manifestation of disease very frequently. The sixth point is that they often cause serious disease, central nervous system disease, malignancies, and immune deficiency. In fact, I think we can say that both categories of human retroviruses, the leukemia viruses and the AIDS virus, can cause central nervous system disease, malignancies directly or indirectly, and a severe immune deficiency in the case of the AIDS virus, and modest changes in immune function in case of the leukemia viruses. They've become increasingly important in our time, and the examples of viruses like this that I would mention would include all the human retroviruses, some of the hepatitis viruses, some papillomaviruses, and even some herpes viruses, albeit the herpes viruses, of course, are much more readily transmissible. We might also include, if we weren't just speaking of humans, viroids, strange particles of RNA only, that can cause epidemics in plants. Who knows, someday they may cause epidemics in man. By changes in 20th century habits, in the case of some viroids that have caused epidemic disease of palm trees, it's been due to the fact that people who prune palm trees have spread viroids from plant after plant, the RNA sticking to the shears that are used to cut the palm tree. We can also speak of so-called prions, as Prusiner calls those agents that are now thought to be only protein, which can cause scrapie in sheep, kuru in man, and Creutzfeldt-Jakob syndrome also in men and possibly other diseases. Now I'll speak almost only about the human retroviruses, and the next slide shows a picture of all the human retroviruses we now know of. There are a few more that have been described in the literature, but they're not yet well characterized to have sufficient credibility. The first to be discovered was HTLV-1, found in the late 1970s and first reported in 1980. Its relative was found a year or two later, which we called HTLV-2. The AIDS virus, causing the epidemic we now face, HIV-1, shown here, found in 83 and established as the cause of AIDS in early 84, and its relative from West Africa, HIV-2, which for reasons we don't understand is not as pathogenic nearly as HIV-1 and is not spreading nearly like HIV-1, but tends to be limited to West Africa. You can note the significant difference in the morphology of the two groups of human retroviruses. Their size and shape are roughly the same, but the core structure of the leukemia viruses is much different than the core structure, when one is lucky enough to get a good picture, of the AIDS virus, which has got a much more condensed and cylindrical shaped core, as shown here. At the very bottom is not a retrovirus. It's a herpes virus, which we first called wrongly HBLV. We isolated this virus in 1986 from a B-cell lymphoma of a patient with AIDS, so we thought it was tropic more for B-cells. Later, postdoctoral named Paolo Lusso in my laboratory found that its primary target was also the CD4 positive T-cell. Human herpes virus number 6 is the first new herpes virus we have in the last 25 years. All viruses shown in that slide predominantly, but not only, target the CD4 positive T-cell. In fact, all the viruses known to chiefly target T4 cells were discovered in the last decade, and they are shown here. We now know that there are other viruses discovered earlier that can also infect the CD4 positive T cell. For example, the human cytomegalovirus. But these are the ones that target chiefly the T4 lymphocyte. Again, not solely, but chiefly. The consequence of infection of the CD4 positive T cell varies with the virus. What happens will depend upon how much the virus replicates and on some aspects of what genes the virus carries. HHV6, the herpes virus, can kill T4 cells when it's actively replicating, as I'll show you later. HIV can kill T4 cells. It can also infect and not do anything demonstrable, at least by laboratory tests, and I'll come back to that point too. Similarly, HIV-2. HTLV-1 and HTLV-2, like most retroviruses, has no lytic activity on its target cell, but can alter the function of that cell, and in the case of some infected T cells, can lead to their immortalized growth in vitro and contribute to the development of leukemia in vivo. The way human retroviruses were discovered is summarized in the next slide in a very simple and quick fashion. The technology that was necessary, that was developed in the 1970s, was sensitive assays for finding them, reverse transcriptase. The discovery of reverse transcriptase by Temin in Baltimore was quickly extended into the finding of a similar enzyme occasionally in human leukemic cells by my colleagues and myself during the ninth period of the 1970s. At least 4 or 5 enzymes were purified that had the properties of the viral enzyme. But more importantly was the development of synthetic template primers. These polymers, synthetic polymers, oligo-DT poly-A, poly-C oligo-DG, that made the assays for these enzymes done in a certain way, both specific and sensitive. Sensitive so that they were better in detecting retroviruses by 1,000-fold more than electron microscopy. Also, the assay using reverse transcriptase is much simpler, much cheaper, and can be continuously done while the culture is ongoing. Electron microscopy does not offer that possibility. Retroviruses in humans complete their replication cycle, as I mentioned earlier, only during one phase of that cell's life. As such, electron microscopy would usually miss the discovery of a new retrovirus of man of the kind that we're talking about. But reverse transcriptase assays could be done continually while the cells are cultured. The second important technology was the ability to grow human T cells, particularly with interleukin-2. The development by the whole field of immunology, which defines subsets of lymphocytes, particularly T cell surface markers, the development of monoclonal antibodies, functional assays, and other assays for T cell subtypes. A third factor contributing to the discovery of human retroviruses is a simple one, the fact that they spread in the 1960s and especially the 1970s. They became much more common, so therefore the chances of isolating them became greater. And the last point I think is worth mentioning is the perseverance in looking for them, even if people didn't think they existed. Now let me move on to some general characteristics of the human retroviruses and spend a minute or two on the human leukemia virus. Next slide, please. I'm sure now all of you are familiar with the fact that human retroviruses not only exist, they belong to two entirely different subclasses. Although both of these are retroviruses, their morphology and some aspects of their genomic organization and some aspects of their biology differ. The HTLVs belong to the more classic type of animal retroviruses known in most species, the type C or the on-corner retroviruses, whereas the HIVs belong to the category known as lentiretroviruses. Lenti is not a good name. It means slow. HIV is not slow compared to HTLVs. They're slower. So the name doesn't have a great deal of meaning. The prototype of the lentiretroviruses until recent years, until the discovery of HIVs, were only known in ungulates, the hoofed animals like horses, sheep, and cows, and goats. And one has to be careful in not drawing too much analogy of the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, to these ungulate lentiretroviruses. Some things are in common, the fact that they infect macrophage. Their core structure, morphologically, are similar, but some of their aspects are very different. For example, some of the ungulate lentiretroviruses can be transmitted casually. The Visna virus of sheep is thought to be transmitted by fomites in crowded sheep that are herded together in a closed environment. As far as I know, none of the ungulate lentiretroviruses target T4 lymphocytes and are not, to my knowledge, ever associated with the increased frequency of the development of malignancy. More recently, we have other animal models in which lentiretroviruses have been isolated that are closer to the human. In fact, although these two belong to very different categories, they have some important biological features that are in common. Some of these are summarized on the next slide. In addition to the obvious that they are human infectious retroviruses, the HIVs and the HTLVs have common modes of transmission. They are transmitted by blood and sex and by mother to child. Men chiefly get infected from their mothers. Males chiefly get infected from their mothers with the HTLVs. And women chiefly get infected from their husband or lover or both. And the mode of transmission from mother to child is in utero, transplacental, as well as by milk or in the actual birth process. Blood transfusions, the use of blood products, of course, also are modes of transmission of both. The major target cell being the CD4 T cell, as we've already spoken about. Let's jump to the fifth point. The closest relative of the human leukemia viruses are found in African monkeys. Such viruses have been called S for simian T cell leukemia virus, STLV. They are not found at all in New World, that is, American monkeys. They are found in Asian monkeys, but the ones present in African monkeys are closer to the human than are the Asian monkey viruses. Similarly, the HIV's closest relative are in African monkeys. Again, no relative of HIV has been found in New World monkeys. No relative of HIV also has not been found in Asian monkeys. So, because of this fact, because the closest relatives of all human retroviruses are present in African primates, the ancestral origin of these viruses is almost certainly African. That does not mean the recent epidemic of AIDS came from Africa, only that the ancestral origin of the viruses did. As far as we can tell, the epidemic of AIDS began almost simultaneously in parts of Central Africa, parts of the Caribbean, particularly Haiti, and the United States, and perhaps Europe, although those records are not as detailed from early studies in Europe, early sera stored in Europe. Another feature that both HIV and HTLVs have in common is a tight control of the DNA-integrated provirus. What I mean by that is that following infection of a CD4-positive T-cell by HTLV-1, HTLV-2, HIV-1, or HIV-2, usually there is no expression of the DNA form of the virus after its integration into RNA. So an infected cell will have no viral RNA and no viral protein. The immune system can't find it. It's one of the ways these viruses escape the immune system, not expressing the protein following infection. Another way it escapes is by infecting the brain. Still another way these viruses can escape, especially, of course, the HIVs, not the HTLVs, is the considerable genomic variation from isolate to isolate that the immune system fails to recognize. In the case of HIV, still another way they escape the immune system is by destroying the immune system in time after infection. But for now, I just want to mention this point. The infection of a cell without expression of the viral protein so that the immune system doesn't see that infected cell. It is when the T cell is immune stimulated, perhaps by another infection, that viral genes become active, along with a variety of other cellular genes. And at this point, the immune system can see the infected cell. But one can argue it's too late, the virus is being released and is now infecting other cells. I'll come back to that point a little bit later because I think it has clinical implications. For example, anybody who's HIV infected who has other chronic infections is likely to be spreading more virus, more HIV. Next slide, please. I'd now like to move into a brief discussion of HTLV-1, the leukemia virus. This is a very old slide. It's a slide that was made in 1981 or 1982. But it still holds to this point. It could use updating, but the essential facts on it are true. Namely, that HTLV-1 is endemic in sub-Saharan Africa. Unfortunately, we can't really draw on a slide the truth. The virus is extremely tightly controlled. It's not present all over sub-Saharan Africa. It may be present in one village and not present in the next. It may be present in one tribe for generations and not present in a tribe next door. It may be present in one side of a river and not on the other side of the river. It introduces some new aspects to the epidemiology of human microbiology. Many of the diseases caused by these viruses, or I should at least say the leukemia, and perhaps the neurologic disease caused by the leukemia virus, would be thought to be a pure genetic inherited disease if we didn't have the virus in hand and be able to trace it. So these are very tightly controlled viruses. And so it's a mistake to shade all of sub-Saharan Africa. It may be here and not here, etc. In general, HTLV-1 is also endemic in the Caribbean basin, the northern part of South America, Central America, most of the Caribbean islands, and parts of southeastern United States. Some Caribbean islands do not have any HTLV-1. It depends where in Africa they originated from. One tribe positive, then the descendants in some Caribbean islands are positive. Another ancestral tribe negative, then the descendants in another Caribbean island are negative for the most part. HTLV-1 is also endemic in the southern islands of Japan, in Shikoku, Kyushu, Okinawa, and other islands. It clusters, or a virus like it, in some villages in Spain, and in southeastern Italy, in a region called Apulia. The virus in Apulia, in southeast Italy, is endemic. It's not a coastal introduction from without in recent times. Rather, it's people living in the hills interior. And some of the molecular analysis of the isolates in that region indicate it's not the classic HTLV-1, but maybe another retrovirus related to HTLV-1. These are very recent studies. There have been clusters of leukemia reported in Amsterdam, also earlier in London, which should have an X, but these are from migrating populations from the Caribbean. No other environmental factor is needed for the cause of leukemia by HTLV-1, at least as far as epidemiology can determine. A child born in Jamaica who stays in the Caribbean has the same rate of developing leukemia as the child born in Jamaica, infected in Jamaica, who migrates to London. The incidence appears to be roughly the same. A great part of the world we have very little data on, at least data that I've seen. So we don't know very much about the infection by HTLV-1 here in the Soviet Union, for example. Now I'd like to turn to the nature of the disease. The next slide. Again, this is a very old slide. A few of my colleagues in the audience have seen it about 1,000 times. This is a picture of the first human from which a retrovirus was isolated. This man comes from the southeastern part of the United States. Obviously, he's a young black male. But he had no past interesting history, medical, family, occupational. He developed a severe acute T-cell malignancy of the T4 lymphocytes. The skin manifestations are infiltrates in the skin of leukemic cells, which is common in this disease. Frequently, there's a high blood calcium. There are molecular mechanisms of explanation of that through liberation of some lymphokines, but it's not certain. But high blood calcium is also a manifestation, and it can lead to death of the individual. There's also an increased incidence of opportunistic infections. Slight immune impairment can be measured in infected people sometimes. And when they disease begins to develop, the course is very rapid. It resembles the chronic myelogenous leukemia going into blast crisis. Death appears in usually less than 6 months. In the late 1970s, the end of 78 and 79, we obtained three isolates of HTLV-1 from this man, two from his peripheral blood and one from a cell line that was established from an inguinal lymph node biopsy. This is, I think, enough about the disease. Only I should tell you that the manifestations I described to you are common in about 70 to 80% of people who have leukemia with HTLV-1. Another 20 to 30% have a more chronic course, and the diagnosis would not be the classical adult T-cell leukemia. It would go by different names, such as chronic lymphocytic leukemia of a T4 type, mixed cell lymphoma, histiocytic lymphoma of T4 type, and many other names. So any T4 malignancy, one has to consider the possibility of HTLV-1, but particularly if it's this kind of aggressive disease. May I have the next slide, please? I'd now like to turn to the mechanism of how HTLV-1 causes leukemia, but first about its genes and how it replicates and infects cells. Like any retrovirus, HTLV-1 has at each end the long terminal repeat sequences. These sets of nucleotides that are involved in regulation of the viral gene expression and form sites of covalent attachment to cellular sequences on each side after the provirus is integrated. Like any animal retrovirus, it has the three genes for structural proteins, for the GAG gene for the viral core proteins, the POL gene for the enzymes, including reverse transcriptase, and the M gene for the envelope, of course. In animal retroviruses, these were the only genes known. With the rare exception of the ONC gene, which usually gave the retrovirus the inability to reproduce itself without a helper. So we won't talk further about ONC genes. It has nothing to do with the replication of the virus. When the molecular biology of HTLV-1 and HTLV-2 were completed, it became evident that they introduced into retrovirology new structure, new genes, present at the 3' end of the genome. Originally, this was called TAT, T-A-T. Later, with the discovery of HIV-1 and HIV-2, these were called TAT-1, so on. But now, the new terminology for the last few years, this gene is now called TAX, T-A-X. This makes a 40,000 Dalton protein located in the nucleus. REX, R-E-X, is a second gene in the 3' region of HTLV-1 and HTLV-2. You should also note that these genes are from two segments of the genome. They are products of doubly spliced messenger RNAs. This also was new in retrovirology. The GAG protein, the POL, and the ENV are formed from unspliced or singly spliced messenger RNA molecules. This is what was known among animal retroviruses, that the messenger RNA that encoded those proteins was spliced once or spliced not at all.
But these two new genes are products of doubly spliced messenger RNAs. We earlier realized that the protein product of these genes are absolutely essential for the replication of HTLV1 and HTLV2. They are also essential for their biological activity. The next slide, please. We can now look at the replication cycle of the human leukemia viruses, and we can divide the cycle into two parts. The first part, like any animal retrovirus, involves an attachment phase to the cell membrane. We do not know the receptor for HTLV1 or 2. We do not know the receptor for most of the animal retroviruses. We do know the chromosomal loci of the receptor, which Robin Weiss and his colleagues in London have determined some few years ago, but I don't remember, and I won't say anything further about it. Following attachment, there's a fusion of viral envelope with cell membrane lipid bilayer, and then the emptying into the cytoplasm of the cell of the viral core. The viral RNA, shown in yellow, is transcribed in the cytoplasm, and then you form the double-stranded linear DNA, which gets to the nucleus and integrates. So this part of the life cycle is not different from what we know of animal retroviruses. What differs begins here. With most animal retroviruses, after integration of a target cell which is permissive to the replication of the virus, there's a quick transition from this side to this side. That means that with most animal retroviruses infecting a permissive cell, the proviral integrated DNA is expressed straight away. There's sufficient cellular factors, sufficient viral and cellular machinery, allowing for quick transcription of the DNA provirus to reform viral RNA in the nucleus. The viral RNA then comes to the cytoplasm and assembles at the cell membrane with viral proteins that have been formed by unspliced or singly spliced messenger RNAs transported to the cytoplasm. The viral proteins are processed, particularly by cleavage through a viral protease and a cellular protease, the former for viral core protein, the latter for viral envelope protein. And this, after assembly, budding and release, completes the replication cycle. HTLV1 and HTLV2 introduce a new complexity, and that complexity goes back to the nucleus. In order to have successful transcription of the DNA provirus to viral RNA, there is first the expression of an early gene product. This is new in retrovirology. It was known in some DNA tumor viruses that some genes were expressed early, some late, the early and late genes. But for retrovirology, this was a new concept. We now know that the first genes to be expressed are TAX and REX, and that the TAX protein, we don't know what turns it on, that's still kind of mysterious, but the TAX protein is essential for the early transcriptional events to make the viral RNA. The function of the REX protein is not only new in retrovirology, but has introduced some new mechanisms into all of molecular biology. The REX protein is involved in removal or transport of the messenger RNAs for the viral structural proteins, that is, the messenger RNAs that are doubly spliced. Another way of saying this is that in the absence of REX, the only messenger RNAs that are made are the messenger RNAs that are doubly spliced, that is, the messenger RNAs for themselves, for REX and TAX. But once the REX protein is made, you favor the formation of the unspliced RNAs, or the singly spliced RNAs, which are the messenger RNAs for the viral structural proteins. So this is an interesting mechanism by which once the REX protein is made, it downregulates itself, it downregulates TAX, and allows the formation of the viral proteins so that there's a sudden release of virus during the narrow window which the human retroviruses have to complete their cycle. This point is more detailed than I would have liked to have gone into, but it is a general one. It's a mechanism we also see with HIV. And the HIV mechanism that uses genes somewhat like TAX and REX are not found in all the lentiretroviruses of animals. In fact, this may be a convergent evolution of use of mechanisms for infection of human T cells by two entirely different classes of human retroviruses, and I'll come back to that point later. Now, what does this have to do with the ability of these viruses to cause leukemia? Many of you, maybe most of you, possibly all of you know, but the TACS protein is a transacting protein. It acts in trans to be involved in the transcription of viral RNA. But TACS also activates cellular genes. It activates cellular genes indirectly. TACS complexes to some cellular proteins, some cellular transcriptional factors that are involved in the turning on of important genes for T cell proliferation, genes like interleukin-2 and interleukin-2 receptor. It's somewhat ironical that the very protein interleukin-2, the system used to grow T cells to isolate the virus, is the very system that the virus uses or turns on in its first stages of causing leukemia, at least in the way we think about it today. The TACS protein is also involved in turning on other cellular genes. Dr. Verma, who's at this meeting, has shown that the TACS protein is involved in the turning on of the CFOS proto-oncogene, for example. I'd like to summarize our current thinking of the mechanism of the function of HTLV-1 in leukemia with the next slide. Okay, in summary, the development of adult T-cell leukemia by HTLV-1, probably also by HTLV-2, is shown here. Let's start with the bottom. This indicates that about one-third, perhaps, of T-cells may be infected by HTLV-1. This shows the integrated provirus in orange. Note that there's no expression, so the immunological system cannot see the cell to attack it. At some stage, the TACS protein shown in red is turned on. We do not know, as I said earlier, what leads to the turning on of TACS. But once this occurs, then other viral proteins can be turned on. I show in pink the viral envelope, HTLV1M protein here, as an indication of all the viral proteins. So now we're expressing viral proteins, but also the TACS turns on interleukin-2, shown in yellow as circles, and the receptor, shown in blue, for interleukin-2. And you may know that the receptor for interleukin-2 is a complex structure made of several polypeptides, possibly as many as 7. The high affinity polypeptide that binds best IL-2 is activated by TACS. This, we think, leads to an autocrine and paracrine phenomena, which allows for a polyclonal T cell expansion. This is not a malignancy. So we have a polyclonal T cell expansion, which can be documented in many people infected by HTLV-1. We think what happens after this is that because of the expression also of the viral proteins, the immune system attacks and clears the proliferating cells, so we're back to here. And that this goes round and round and round for years and years and years, maybe for decades. But this is the role of the virus to increase the expansion of proliferating T cells so that some unfortunate people, estimated recently in Japan to be 3 to 5% of the infected individuals per lifetime, will develop another genetic event. This, I assume, is an accident, a mutation, a rearrangement that we don't understand, just happening by chance. Those people then develop the second event, which would be the clonal transformed leukemic cell, the true leukemia. There may be still a third genetic event which leads to the blast crisis analogous to chronic myelogenous leukemia. There is not yet complete agreement on a specific chromosomal change to account for the second or the third event. There are some that are common but not consistent, so I can't speak further about that. In any case, this is our current view of how this virus leads to the development of leukemia. The next slide, please. HTLV-1 is now known to also cause a serious and fatal progressive neurologic disease, which is similar to multiple sclerosis but can be distinguished from it. Now, there's a little bit of confusion in this area. because there are some laboratories that have reported HTLV-1 or a closely related virus as being involved in multiple sclerosis itself. This data is not consistent from lab to lab, and I don't think there's enough evidence to say that HTLV-1 or a relative of HTLV-1 plays a role in multiple sclerosis. But this neurologic disease that has been called tropical spastic paraparesis, it has also been called Jamaican neuropathy, it has also been misdiagnosed as multiple sclerosis or a variant of multiple sclerosis, is certainly HTLV-1 is linked to that disease in a causative manner. But we do not know the mechanism. That disease differs from multiple sclerosis in that it doesn't go like this. It doesn't have periods of getting better. It's progressive. It's characterized by incontinence of the bladder, by impotence in a male, by loss of bowel function, and by spasticity of the lower extremities. The disease can occur rapidly after infection with HTLV-1. It appears to depend on the dose of the virus. There's a recent report in the New England Journal of Medicine of a Frenchman who was transfused with HTLV-positive blood and developed the neurologic disease in 5 weeks and transmitted the virus to his wife during that period. So we feel it's important to test blood for this virus, not just for HIV. But the neurologic disease can also take years to develop. As I said, I believe it depends on the dose of the virus. But there's also some indications that genetic factors are important. There's some reports from Japan of HLA characteristics, HLA class 2, that certain patterns have an increased frequency of developing the neurologic disease. What I can tell you of facts are that we cannot find the virus in the central nervous system, in the tissue. You can find it in cerebrospinal fluid, but not in the brain cells or cells of the spinal cord. What we can also say as fact is that people who develop the neurologic disease have a very, very high titer of antibody, much higher than the healthy carrier or the leukemic patient. This has led to speculation that this is an autoimmune response to the virus, that this is an autoimmune disease. That's roughly where things are now. In a meeting about 4 months ago that was the 10th anniversary of the discovery of human retroviruses held in Hawaii, I heard several epidemiologic papers, some from Africa, some from South America, the Caribbean, and Japan, that indicate that HTLV-1 is also involved or linked epidemiologically to other diseases that are shown in the next slide. We've already talked about adult T-cell leukemia and the occasional other T4 leukemias or lymphomas. We've also discussed the tropical spastic paraparesis. What is now being claimed from epidemiologic studies that infection with HTLV-1 has an increased incidence of mild immune impairment, polymyositis, rheumatoid arthritis-like disease, a retinitis, let's forget number 8, it's too complicated, and a Guillain-Barré syndrome, and a lot of discussion about a possible cofactor role in AIDS, which I'll mention in just a moment. Now I'd like to turn to a discussion of the AIDS virus in a summary form. Next slide, please. The idea that AIDS might be caused by a T4 cell lymphotropic retrovirus came from discussions with Dr. Essex and his colleagues in Boston on feline leukemia virus, discovered in the 1960s by Jarrett in Scotland and shown by Jarrett William and his brother Oswald that this virus can cause immune deficiency as well as leukemia. Essex did an epidemiologic study in the early 1980s, again with feline leukemia virus, highlighting its greater importance in immune suppression than in causing leukemia. An additional reason of thinking about a retrovirus in AIDS came from the studies of HTLV-1 epidemiology. The fact that AIDS was endemic in Central Africa, so was HTLV-1. The targeting of T4 cells by the HTLVs, the mode of transmission by sex, blood, and maternal fetal, the fact that HTLV-1 could be immunosuppressive, although modestly, and in the early 1980s, the fact that HTLV-2 was discovered with the possibility of more human retroviruses became more palatable. All these things made thoughts of ideas that a new human retrovirus, perhaps from a mutation or a recombinant, a change in an HTLV-1 emerging from Africa, moving to Haiti and then to the United States. So was HTLV-1. The targeting of T4 cells by the HTLVs, the mode of transmission by sex, blood, and maternal fetal, the fact that HTLV-1 could be immunosuppressive, although modestly, and in the early 1980s, the fact that HTLV-2 was discovered with the possibility of more human retroviruses became more palatable. All these things made thoughts of ideas that a new human retrovirus, perhaps from a mutation or a recombinant, a change in an HTLV-1 emerging from Africa, moving to Haiti and then to the United States, etc. This was the notion that led to people, including ourselves, looking for a new retrovirus. However, ironically, the cause of AIDS is not a variant of HTLV-1. It's not a recombinant with HTLV-1 and something else. But as you know, another category of human retroviruses that simply has these properties in common. So although HTLV-1 was a good lesson and led to ideas, it does not turn out to be the exact model, nor the exact kind of genomic organization. It's in a different subfamily. Next slide. When we think today about how the disease AIDS develops, I believe it is best to divide it into four separate components. There is, of course, the highlight of AIDS, the immune deficiency. Immune deficiency with opportunistic infections. There is also, however, an increased incidence of infection with real pathogens because of the lifestyle of the individual, for example, people receiving blood. Or because of the immune impairment, there is going to be not only an increased incidence of opportunistic infection, but also of real pathogens like tuberculosis, herpes viruses, HTLVs, papillomaviruses, hepatitis virus, and so on. And separate from 1 in 4 is the infection of the brain. Subsequent to infection of the brain, there's loss of thinking and time, often to the point of dementia. Sometimes some types of psychosis can occur as well. Many people have talked about potential theoretical cures of infected people with intracellular molecular vaccines and certain ideas of bone marrow transplant. These ideas are very interesting and I think important. Let's say if an HIV-infected person's bone marrow is obtained, cells that are uninfected are isolated, such cells are transfected, or retroviral vectors carrying viral genes are put into them. Some envelope component may prevent that cell from ever being infected by HIV. So it's theoretically doable to have a population of bone marrow cells that could be protected against infection by HIV. In such a way, one might repopulate the normal immune system and so escape from some of the damage. But one has to realize that this would not stop the problem. It would help prolong life theoretically, but would do nothing for the infection of the brain. So in the United States, where we have 1 to 2 million infected people, perhaps they would live longer, but the probability is that ultimately they would all have brain abnormalities due to the separate infection of the brain. Obviously, we can't take the brain out and do transfections. The last point I want to mention is abnormal cell growth, B-cell lymphomas and Kaposi sarcoma. For the remaining minutes, I would like to tell you a little bit of our thinking about the immune deficiency and a summary of our thoughts about the Kaposi sarcoma. Next slide, please. The essence of the AIDS problem in my mind, at least, of the immune suppression is summarized with this cartoon slide. With tremendous affinity for a part of the envelope of HIV, a portion of the GP120 interacting with the CD4 molecule. This interaction has been described as tighter, greater, than the affinity of many antigens for antibody. Since CD4 is expressed in the surface of cells that are important for the immune system, such as the T helper lymphocytes, but also some macrophage, and also relatives of macrophage like microglial cells of the brain, Langerhans cells widely distributed in the body, and the follicular dendritic cell of the germinal center of the lymph nodes, the AIDS virus can immediately, upon infection, put its head into the center of the immune function, immune system. Many people are thinking of using and trying in animal systems to use CD4 in therapy of people who are infected. To use CD4 as a molecular decoy to bind virus before the virus finds CD4 on the cell surface. It seems to be the most rational approach to the therapy of this disease. Unexpectedly, however, CD4 is rapidly excreted by humans, and so the results have been extremely disappointing. Much research in the United States, and also I think in Europe, by pharmaceutical companies is focused on modification of CD4. For example, Genentech's use of immunoglobulin covalently attached to CD4 molecule seems to prolong the half-life of CD4, diminishing its rate of excretion. Jonathan Gershoni from the Weizmann Institute in Israel, working in our laboratory, has made oligomers of CD4 that have tighter interaction with the GP120 of HIV. It's another approach. Now let's look at the genes of HIV and its replication cycle. Next slide. I'm sure most or all of you are aware that the genome of HIV 1 and 2 is significantly more complex even than HTLV-1 or HTLV-2. In addition to the three genes that all retroviruses have, GAG, POL, ENV, and in addition to the analogous genes of TAX and REX of HTLV-1 and 2, which we here call TAT and REV, in addition to those two genes, which are, like TAX and REX, absolutely essential to the replication cycle of HIV, and probably critical to its biological ability to cause AIDS, there are many other genes that the AIDS virus carries. VIF, which is essential for cell-free infection by these viruses. VPR, which recently Vefa Franchini in my laboratory discovered is essential for infection of primary human macrophage, but not T cells. VPU, whose function is not yet well known. NEF, that's very controversial as whether it does nothing to virus replication or slightly downregulates it. And at least two more genes discovered in the last year or so, particularly by Hazeltine and his colleagues, whose functions are not yet well understood. We won't have time to go through each of these genes in detail, but I'd like to, with the next slide, summarize some of the essential features of the replication cycle of HIV. Well, there's not much different as far as we know of the first part again. Attachment, penetration, RNA to DNA, integration, if the target cell is a T4 cell. Actually, we do not know if HIV provirus integrates into macrophage. Of course, what is known is that the CD4 molecule is at least part of the receptor for HIV. And again, the receptor is not known for almost any other retrovirus, but for HIV it is known, at least in part. Like HTLV-1 and 2, following integration there's a silent period, a latent period. After T-cell activation, we then get expression of the DNA provirus to reform viral RNA and viral proteins. And if you remember what I told you for TAX and REX, these genes, their products, TAT and REV, have the same kind of functional corollary. In fact, work at Duke University by Warner Green and Brian Cullen have shown that if you mutate or remove the REV gene of HIV, although you lose replication of the virus, you can restore it with the REX gene of HTLV-1. Now, what happens to an infected T cell after the infectious state, after infection occurs? There's a long silent period of infection where nothing happens to the cell. But if we immune stimulate that cell, next slide, we complete the cycle. Next slide. And the virus comes out in a burst and the cell dies. So contrary to the notions of some, retroviruses can be cytopathic and cytolytic. Anybody who works with HIV for a few days knows this to be a fact. And actually, it was known earlier from work by Temin with one avian virus, two avian retroviruses. So retroviruses can occasionally be cytopathic, even cytolytic. And this is an example. Is this why the T4 cells become depleted in AIDS? We think this is the major way, killing directly. But also, you may know that HIV has the capacity to form tremendous multinucleated giant cells. When the virus is forming, the envelope protein, GP120, is on the surface first. If there are nearby uninfected cells, but expressing the CD4 molecule, there will be binding and fusion of the two cells. And this can give rise to literally hundreds of cells fused together, which prematurely die and, of course, don't function normally. There are also other ways we might conjecture to account for the T4 cell depletion. But these are all laboratory investigations. We really don't know how to extrapolate this to the clinic, to the in vivo. But at least it's worth mentioning to you that the envelope protein of HIV, GP120, falls off the virus easily. In vitro studies show that the GP120, the envelope protein, can interfere with T cell activation, can also lead to the downregulation of interleukin-2 expression in uninfected T cells when this binds to CD4. There are still other indirect mechanisms that we could talk about, but time does not permit to account for the T4 depletion. I'd like to now turn to the infection of the macrophage. Next slide. And I'm going to only show this one slide to show you this part blown up. This is the first time I ever saw this in retrovirology, namely, that there was infectious whole virus inside the cytoplasm of the cell, in vesicles. This happens in some, but not all macrophage. We do not know why. The important question, however, is that what if the immune system attacks this cell and destroys it? Would you release more infectious virus? The answer is, in laboratory studies, yes. If we take an infected macrophage and we break it manually or by using cytotoxic T cells, we liberate more infectious virus. Therefore, immune therapy that kills infected macrophage must also consider the need for direct antiviral attack, for example, AZT, or neutralizing antibodies. Neutralizing antibodies against the AIDS virus work by complexing to a certain region of GP120 and blocking entry into the cell. Why doesn't the person who is infected by HIV stop spread of the virus? Let's summarize that with the next slide. We know that HIV varies from each person we isolate the virus from. A postdoctoral who worked in my laboratory in 1984, who came from Munich, Germany, Beatrice Hahn, when she was working with my former coworker, Flossie Wongstahl, and myself, discovered heterogeneity of HIV in our laboratory for the first time. She found that no two viruses were the same. If she looked at one person and she found the virus in another person, there was variation. 4%, 5, 10, 15 of the genome. The variation is predominantly in the envelope. What came later from studies of another postdoctoral, this time one from England, Mandy Fisher, who's here at this meeting, also working with my former colleague, Dr. Wongstahl. Mandy showed that within any one virus, there were minor variants. That is to say that if you isolate the virus from one person with AIDS, although most of the viral particles will be very closely related, there is still some variation, and this in time has been shown to have biologic significance. For instance, if this is one virus, one strain, I show different colors that there are minor variants. At time zero, let us say blue dominates, this would be essentially identical particles, and the neutralizing antibody neutralizes almost all of this virus. 3 or 4 months later, another minor variant, perhaps only in one amino acid in the envelope, may emerge, and this may not be neutralized by the original antibody. We have been able to study this in a lab worker who was mass-producing virus and who was infected by accident. So you could follow that person in time. With one strain of the virus, you know what strain it is and you know when the person got infected. This seems to be an important way by which this virus continues to escape the immune system. Antibody develops, can neutralize, new minor variants emerge, they are not neutralized. This is true not only with neutralizing antibody, but with cellular immunity as well. Next slide, please. I have two last points I want to mention. Let's forget this. This is just shows the envelope, and here's the region of the epitope that gives rise to neutralizing antibodies. The blue color is hypervariable. Unfortunately, the neutralizing epitope is in a hypervariable region. But in addition to variation here, you can have mutation completely far away. For example, in GP41, you can have a mutation in GP41 that also affects the interaction of antibody with this site. So these are conformational changes due to mutations at a distance. Next slide, please. I want to make two final points. One is the possibility of alone. In this small study of homosexuals in Trinidad, gave Bartholomew the notion that HTLV-1 may be a cofactor in AIDS. There are additional reports now that agree with this, from Japan and hemophiliacs, from New Jersey with drug addicts. It doesn't mean you need HTLV-1. You don't need it at all. You get AIDS with HIV alone. But the rate of progression may be accelerated in the presence of HTLV-1. Next slide, please. The possible mechanisms are several. HTLV-1 can lead itself to minor T-cell impairment. The TAX protein of HTLV-1, I didn't mention earlier, can also activate HIV if the cells are both, if the virus is infecting the same cell. In addition, HIV-1 infected T-cells can be activated by the simple interaction of HTLV-1 with the cell membrane. Finally, my postdoctoral Paolo Lusso has shown that HTLV-1 and HIV can form phenotypically mixed virus particles, which gives HIV the ability to infect cell types it normally could not infect. I want to mention one other possible cofactor. At the beginning of this talk, I mentioned to you the new herpes virus, HHV6. I mentioned that it infected principally CD4 positive T cells. Next slide, please. This is another picture of that virus. Next slide. And this is again data from my postdoctoral Lusso, which shows that this herpes virus can also kill T cells. These are uninfected human mononuclear cells, the number of CD4 positive cells shown on the vertical axis, obtained from peripheral blood or cord blood. Uninfected cells, the lifespan, infected with HIV in yellow after immune activation shows the killing. Infected with HHV6 in blue, and if you're double infect, in green. The important point is that this herpes virus kills T4 cells better than the AIDS virus. But in the United States, 70 to 80% of all people are infected with this herpes virus. Therefore, obviously in most people, it causes no problem. It's the cause of roseola in babies, not a very serious disease. But in adults who have antibody, we control the replication of the virus. But it is possible that in AIDS, with immune impairment, that there is an increased replication of this virus. If so, we have to consider damage to the immune system by direct killing of T cells by this virus. In addition, this herpes virus can activate HIV. It has a gene, makes a protein, which can transactivate the expression of HIV. Just like HTLV-1 TAX protein. And finally and lastly, recently, again Lusso, this postdoctoral who does a lot of imaginative things in our group, has discovered, not yet published, that human herpes virus number 6 is, as far as I know, the only biological agent we know of that exists naturally that turns on at the transcriptional level CD4. And to my knowledge, this is the first time one virus can turn on the receptor of another. In TH cells, in some epithelial cells, infection by HHV6 turns on CD4 so that they can become targets of HIV. Next slide. Now, my last point, and because of the hour, I'll just make in a summary, is on the role of HIV in Kaposi sarcoma. I'm just going to show you a couple of slides on this. The summary is that we were looking for new viruses in Kaposi sarcoma with AIDS because of the great increase in Kaposi sarcoma in HIV-positive people, but also in the United States, more in homosexuals. It led us to think that there might be another virus. So we looked, and we didn't find another virus. But in looking, we developed a system for studying Kaposi sarcoma. In my mind, I do not agree with criticism that ideas are cheap. I think ideas are important, but in the absence of systems, we cannot test ideas. And the important thing that came out of our results over the last few years is that we have a system in the laboratory for studying Kaposi sarcoma. We can grow the spindle cells, which are believed to be the tumor cell of Kaposi. And that's shown in the next slide. These are spindle cells derived from a person with Kaposi grown for several months. Now we have several that have been grown for more than 1 year. The spindle cells have been analyzed in collaboration with Judah Volkman from Harvard. They have the properties of primitive smooth muscle cells of vascular origin, as well as some properties of endothelial cells. So we believe that the precursor tumor cell of Kaposi is a mesenchymal primitive precursor of smooth muscle endothelial cells. What we found is that this cell, although we could not find virus, releases a number of cytokines that have powerful angiogenic activity. Next slide, please. This is a key feature of Kaposi. Next slide. And this shows some of the angiogenic activity released by the spindle cells grown in the lab. Here's the normal chick chorioallantoic membrane. Here's the same chick membrane in which we take some of the spindle cells and apply it to the membrane or concentrated conditioned media from those spindle cells. So they have angiogenic activity secreted by the spindle cell. More interesting, we took these spindle cells that we cultured and grew successfully, and we put them into a nude mouse. Next slide. And this shows that a tumor developed. The tumor develops near the site of inoculation of the spindle cell. The tumor develops within 10 days of inoculation of the spindle cells. When the spindle cells regress, the tumor dies out. We examined the tumor. Next slide. And it looks like, next slide. It looks like early Kaposi sarcoma with blood vessel proliferation, fibroblasts, infiltration with leukocytes, and spindle cells. So the conclusion is that the spindle cells secrete something that creates the early lesion of Kaposi sarcoma. Next slide. We have evaluated what cytokines it makes, and the two most important are interleukin-1 and basic fibroblast growth factor. So to summarize, the spindle cells grown in our lab derived from Kaposi sarcoma make lots of cytokines. The most important in quantity are interleukin-1 and BFGF. These molecules can have angiogenic activity directly and indirectly. They also promote growth of fibroblasts and endothelial cells directly or indirectly. In addition to those, there's also GM-CSF, TGF-beta, and low levels of acidic fibroblast growth factor, or ECGF, and also PDGF. Now, I didn't tell you how we grew the spindle cells. We grew the spindle cells by using a lymphokine that we think is novel, and it's made by chronically activated T4 cells. So this lymphokine, which is now being purified in our lab, is a potent growth factor, and it comes from activation of T cells. But in addition, we found that the TAT protein is released by infected T cells, and at very small levels, nanogram amounts, is also a growth factor for the spindle cells. Next slide. there's no time to go into this, but this is a look at the TAT molecule, and it's this region of the molecule that has the growth-promoting activity on the spindle cells. So this small protein of 10,000 Daltons is very complex. It has a region that is important for dimerization, a region important for the transactivation of the virus, this acidic domain. It has a basic domain important for the nuclear localization, and we think it is in this region that is important for the growth-promoting effect on the spindle cells. And then my last slide's a summary. Next slide, please. We have talked about the direct effect of a retrovirus like HTLV1, where virus infects its target cell, can immortalize that cell, make it abnormal. When we look at a tumor, we find the viral sequences in every cell in the same place, indicating it's clonal, derived from this transformed original cell. We would call this a direct tumor virus in a way, but I'm now referring to the indirect effects of a retrovirus that can lead to the increased possibility of a tumor development. It's argumentative whether you want to call this a cause or not. But with HIV, we think it infects a primitive mesenchymal cell that has lineage to smooth muscle and endothelium, that this cell then will release TAT protein, this is infecting the T cell, which is releasing TAT protein. Activated T cells also release lymphokine, which can have an effect on this primitive mesenchymal cell, which is the precursor of the spindle cell of Kaposi's sarcoma. This cell, we'll call cell B, in turn releases a series of cytokines that act to form the complex mixed tumor that we call Kaposi's sarcoma. In summary, next slide, we've talked about a period of the 1970s, which was the technology development to find human retroviruses, both in virology, molecular biology, and immunology. The 1980s, their isolation, their characterization, and linkage to respective disease. 1990s, we hope, will be the period of getting rid of them. This is for all human retrovirology. And the last slide is a little closer summary, the last slide, please, of the period of AIDS history, which was taken from Jonathan Mann with my last modification, Roman numeral 5. Mann speaks of the silent period of spread, which really I would say begins in the 60s, not the 70s, to 1981 when the disease was first recognized. Recognition 81, 82, a period of intense discovery in the epidemiology, the virology, and molecular biology 82 to 85. Mann then speaks of the global mobilization, education 1986 to 88. And I added ending the problem, the blood test starting in 84, publication on a global scale in 86, antiviral treatment with AZT in 86, and the big question mark, the development of the vaccine. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Rowley. Thank you, Professor Gallo, for the brilliant lectures. Now, a coffee break, 15 or 20 minutes.